fixing the time of an occurrence and answering the question, when did it happen? But the phrase is also of explanatory significance as well, determining the etiology of an event and thus responding to the inquiry, why did it happen? You see, Vahibime is not only when did it happen, a question of date and fixing of time. It's simply the Vahibime is always contains an explanation of the background, of the causes which brought about a certain event, of the entire etiology of the occurrence. In light of the above, I cannot give you examples because the time is too short, but as a rule, it works. In the light of the above said, the first introductory remark of the Book of Esther, Vayibimei Achashverosh, attempts not only to inform the reader when the events recorded in the book took place, but also why they happened at all. For the story of Esther tells us in the most lively, realistic, and fashion, and in finest, most beautiful prose, about paradoxical events. They're not rational events, which are both tragic and comical. About a king who, as our rabbi said, killed his beloved, beautiful queen at the suggestion and upon the advice of a friend of his, Memuchan. He advised the king to kill Vashti. And later executed his best friend, Haman, his prime minister, upon the request and complaint of his beautiful queen Esther. It is both a funny book and a sad book about a king per se, not wicked at all, not cruel at all, with a certain streak of liberalism, who signed a decree to exterminate the people he did not know, and later denied knowledge of the entire incident when Esther complained to him. The story tells us about a commonwealth, because it was an empire, Persia, of many nations, of many races, which spoke a variety of languages, practiced many cults, observed an enormous amount of rituals. And that commonwealth, I mean, the king is the representative of the commonwealth, suddenly decided to commit genocide for one reason only, because the people were abiding by regulations, statutes, and laws different from those of other peoples. How is it possible, we ask ourselves, that not a single voice was raised in protest or in despair? And apparently, I mean, Achashverosh didn't mind demonstrations, because if he did mind, he wouldn't have allowed Mordechai, I mean, to wrap himself in sackcloth and cry in a loud voice. Anybody could parade in front of the king's gates, in front of the palatial grounds. They couldn't enter because Ein Lo Ve'el Sha'ar HaMelech Belvushto, but they could parade. No one interfered. Mordecai demonstrated in front of the royal palace, No state troopers have blocked his way. Enjoy the same freedom as the people who say no, or those who protest and parade, enjoy in the United States. However, it's strange, no one else joined Mordecai. If we read the Megillah carefully, between the lines, you see that Mordecai was the only individual who cried with a bitter and loud voice. Neither Gentile or even Jew, neither friend nor stranger, have joined Mordecai when he actually protested against the decree of genocide. And the Pasuk just says, Voir Shushan Novecho. What does it mean, Novecho? Mean in mourning, oh no. Novecho means perplexed. Nevuchim in Aboret. Confused. The city was confused. The city of Shushan was perplexed. What happened? The Jews did not believe. They refused to face reality, as many Jews in the 40s did not believe. You read the literature about the disaster. That many Jews in Warsaw did not believe, for instance, that Lodz is being destroyed, the population of Lodz is being deported to gas chambers and crematoria. They did not believe, they refused to believe. The non-Jew did not care. Moreover, the story is puzzling because of another coincidence. It's very puzzling. A short time before the decree was issued, short time, most probably, we don't know how long it took, the entire population of Shushan was invited to the 7-day feast on the grounds of the royal palace. He invited everybody, Jew and Gentile alike, without discriminating between Jew and non-Jew, between races and colors, and to all the people that were present in Shushan HaBirah, not only those who lived in Shushan who were present, tourists, guests, visitors, everybody was invited. Of course, if they all were invited to the feast, to the banquet, they fraternized, Jew and non-Jew. Chazal described it. They toasted to each other, they shook hands, they hugged each other. Of course, if you are a little intoxicated, you begin to demonstrate or manifest your emotions, your feelings. And suddenly, just a short time later, achar hadvarim ha'ele, a ruthless, inhuman edict was issued and sent hastily sent, with the couriers of the king to all parts of the Commonwealth, lehashmid, leharig, uleabid, to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish all Jews, both old and young, little children and women, in one day. How was it possible? We ask ourselves, if we read the Megillah carefully, cautiously, how was it possible that the same people just few days ago, drank together, feasted together, ate together, should suddenly turn into enemies, into fiends? What is more amazing is a cryptic remark in the Megillah. Arotzim yotzotrufim bedvar ha-melech ve'ados nitno b'shushan ha-biro ve'amelech v'homon yoshvu lishteis the most remarkable pasuk in the Megillah. And the pasuk just in 10, 12 words describes, I mean, portrays, I mean, the mentality and the reaction, the response of the people in Shushan, the response and the reaction of Ahasuerus himself to the edict he just signed, Haman's reaction to the edict. The post went forth in haste, and the decree was given in Shushan, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. The king and Haman celebrated their recent victory by feasting and wine. What did they celebrate? Neither one has understood actually what is going to happen. I don't believe that Ahasuerus had any concept of what he signed, of what Haman wanted him to do, with hundreds of thousands of Jews, of people, old and young, children and infants, mothers and fathers, who will perish for no reason on this earth. He was feasting with Ahasuerus. It's so the irony in the statement. Amelech v'homon yoshu lishteis. Or at least Amelech v'homon yoshu lishteis, they were brooding, or somehow the Melech had doubts, or Homan himself was not too sure. No, Amelech v'homon yoshu lishteis, it didn't matter at all. It didn't matter at all. As if nothing had happened. As if nothing had transpired. All right. They took it in. Let me ask you, my friends, the audience here, is it a question relevant to our understanding of antiquity? Is this question only relevant to the understanding of antiquity, of an episode which happened so many, was probably 2,500 years ago? Or no? A similar episode, in quotation marks, took place in the 30s and in the 40s in Europe. The same question can be repeated almost verbatim. How was it possible that the Western world, including the German people themselves, and the German people, whether we like it or we don't like it, is so-called in the commonly accepted terminology, is a civilized people who has greatly contributed to what we call Western civilization and Western culture. You cannot deny it. Take the German contribution to music away, you have no music. There is no music if you take away the German contribution. It's a fact. I'm not a German patriot, you know that very well. I've never been a German Jew. I mean, and certainly not now. But take away the German contribution to music, you have no music. Take a list of all concerts, I mean, the program. Take a program of any concert, in any symphony hall. What kind of music do they play? Bach and Haydn and Beethoven and Mozart. German music. Not only music, take away the German contribution to philosophy. It's almost there is no philosophy. And in science, of course, many people have contributed, but their contribution was a very considerable one. How could it be that the German people and the Western world could witness not just the signing and the issuance of an edict, as it happened, I mean, in the times of Ahasuerus, of a decree, for the real extermination of 6 million Jews in crematoria and gas chambers, and did not say a single word of protest and condemnation. How, we ask again, was it possible that a man like Roosevelt, for instance, who certainly was not a bigot, or a jubator, who surely was of liberal persuasion, I mean, you know his politics, I mean, in the United States, I mean, and who finally helped the free world to destroy Hitler. If someone else had been elected instead of Roosevelt, who knows what would happen? Because Roosevelt basically hated Hitler. And he helped the free world destroy Hitler. But the same Roosevelt who destroyed the maniac of Berchtesgaden did not move his little finger to help the victims of Majdanek and Oświęcim and Treblinka and Buchenwald, etc., etc. On the contrary, he asked Dr. Wise, that the story about the extermination of the Jews in the various crematoria be suppressed and be not disclosed to the press. He was afraid the Jews will bring pressure upon the government in Washington. It should do something in order to save the innocent victims, the babies and the little children and the old women. When the suggestion was made that the American Air Force bomb Majdanek, Oświęcim, so Roosevelt vetoed it upon consulting with General Eisenhower. The reason for vetoing this, or rejecting the request made by the, not by the Jewish community, by many senators and congressmen, it was very, a very simple one. That Majdanek and Oświęcim were not military objectives. And if the American Air Force should drop bombs on Majdanek and Oświęcim, it would be tantamount to the bombardment of civilian installations. It is, frankly, only, it is stupid envy in both. No one said a word, a single word. There were many liberals in the world. Gandhi was still alive. Schweitzer was alive. No one said a single word. And let me ask you, I mean, what is about the Jews of America, about ourselves? We did not believe, because we did not want to believe. Did we rend our clothes? Did we try did we cry a bitter and loud cry as Mordechai did? The rest of the world was confused. And again, many did not care. A few did not believe. In the meantime, 6 million Jews were exterminated. Why, we asked. How is it possible? Of course, there is only one answer to that. The problem we raised vis-à-vis the events during the time of Achashverosh, 2,500 years ago, and also the problem we raised vis-à-vis our own behavior, and particular behavior of the Western world, which could save hundreds of thousands of Jews. Churchill, Roosevelt, De Gaulle, and so forth. There is one answer. The answer to that riddle is, of course, to be found in the intrinsic dichotomy of man, in his inner contradiction, and his inherent, incommensurability, in the mysterious word which Chazal has singled out, Vayitzer, with two yudim. Vayitzer should have been spelled with one yud. And the Vayitzer in Chumash, Vayitzer ad Hashem Melekim Odom min Adomo, and God has created men out of the soil, or out of dust. And the Vayitzer has two yudim. And Chazal say, why two yudim? Shteyitziris. There are two creations in man. In man, there is a confrontation between two beings. There are two human ontologies in man. Man is an angel and Satan par excellence at the same time. He can be merciful, he can also be very cruel. Refinement and vulgarity, considerateness and ruthlessness abide in him side by side. And from time to time, Satan takes over. Whether the Satan appears in the disguise of Haman, or in disguise of a liberal person who simply does not care or finds an excuse for lack of concern on his part, is irrelevant. There is evil, that's what Yahadus believed, in men, which may erupt unexpectedly, without any advance notice. Amalek, we just read the Parshas Amalek today, is according to Chachmei HaKabbalah, to the mystics, is not some race, does not represent a race, or an ethnic group, or some Bedouin tribe. According to Kabbalah, Amalek is man himself. He abides in everyone of us. He abides in me, he abides in you. Ready to leap forward and to swoop down upon man who was created in the image of God. Man prophet, man benefactor, merciful man can be defeated easily by Amalek, who abides within man, in every one of us. If you should ask me what is the main concern of Yahadus pertaining to man, what is the basic anthropology, philosophical anthropology of Yahadus? What does Yahadus think about man? What does Yahadus want man to be? I would say that Yahadus wants man to be satisfied with being what he was meant to be by his creator, namely to be man, not less and not more than man. If he is less than man, many people you find, I mean, you come across, you meet in your life, they're a bit less than man, he turns into a beast. If he tries to be more than man, transcending himself and reaching out for vastness and unbounded greatness, he is apt to wake up and find himself in the embrace of the Satan. In fact, the second alternative, which man is, and the possibility that man may choose to be more than he is indeed, is the main problem of modern man. There is no possibility for modern man to descend from the cultural heights he scaled and conquered into the jungle or the cave. There is no possibility. The danger is in reverse, that he may overreach himself and may try to mount greater heights, more challenging peaks, and by so doing, lose his humanity. On his journey to the moon, this is very close to us now, but there will be many journeys, not only to the moon, but to the Mars, to Venus, I mean, to one of the planets of our small solar system, or perhaps to some other system, astronomical system, and his journey to some star, fixed star, he may find, I mean, he may change his identity when he will return from the journey. So he will be in the disguise of Satan. When man ventures to achieve vastness, when all boundaries are erased, all stop signs removed, then he may indeed turn into the serpent. And that's why in Yahadus, and the Rambam particularly emphasized it, the central virtue in Yahadus is humility. But you've got to understand what humility is, I mean. Okay, you thought. Achnoe, the latter expressed itself in an act of self-limitation, in being able, that's what Yahadus kept on teaching us, in being able to give up and to withdraw at a time when conquest is in sight and aggression is rewarding. Now I want to develop one thought here. Basically, Yahadus believed that the human being is fascinated. This will contribute to our understanding of the Megillah. I'll come back to the Megillah later. The human being is fascinated by two visions. Two goals attract his attention and stimulate his fantasy. In his quest for either of the goals, of these two goals, he becomes oblivious to the fact that he is a finite being, that he is a mortal being, that he is a frail being, that he is weak. He becomes oblivious to finiteness and to his limitedness and attempts to attain infinity. The first quest, and Yahadus was very much concerned, perhaps, I would say, 50-75% of the Shulchan Aruch, 75% of the Shulchan Aruch, is related to that quest. Yahadus wanted to control the quest, to limit it, not to eliminate, not to abandon it, but to control it, to limit it, to bound it. This is the quest for beauty or pleasure, for enjoyment of life, unlimited enjoyment of life. Or, if we should use an American colloquialism, it means the pursuit of happiness, the way it is understood by the men on the street. Happiness means unlimited enjoyment of life. Unlimited, what the Greeks used to call hedone. The second quest is for power and authority. And also when man is out to achieve power, to attain authority, to become a ruler, to become a tyrant, his ambition is unlimited. As a matter of fact, we find both quests formulated in Chumash. You know, I don't move. I cannot move one step, make one step without the Chumash. The serpent, Vanocha Shoyorum, whoever he was, but certainly was sly and corrupt, the serpent in his attempt to mislead Adam and Eve to sin, told them, Ki yedei alikim b'yim acholchem imenu, because God Almighty knows that immediately after having eaten from the tree, your eyes will open up and you shall, like the Almighty himself, be able to discriminate between good and evil. It means the urge to sin, is simply a part of the human urge for absolute power and authority. He should legislate laws for himself. He doesn't want to accept the law which is given to him by God. He wants to be the legislator of the law. And if he doesn't like a law which was formulated by God, so he has a right to reject. He'll set up his own rules of behavior. He'll actually, define his moral code. On the other hand, the Pasuk tells us that Eve was also fascinated by the loveliness of the tree, by the beauty of the tree, the passion for enjoyment, for pleasure, for aesthetic fulfillment, made her sin. Quest for enjoyment, for aesthetic fulfillment, and the quest for authority, for power, to rule, to command, to enslave in a variety of ways. You don't need the legal institution of slavery in order to enslave men. You can enslave men in a democratic, liberal society. And explain, your act in the finest prose. The Torah not only has formulated these two quests, has portrayed these two quests on the part of man, but actually let two generations represent these two quests. And I believe you'll guess which generations I am referring to. The Torah tells us about the Deira Mabul, the generation of the flood, and Deira Afloge, the generation which wanted to build a very tall tower, the skyscraper. Vereshi Bashomayim, the apex should be in heaven. The Deira Mabul generation, which was wiped off by the flood, represents orgiastic men, the men of pleasure. The generation was dominated by the quest for hypnotic pleasure, for compulsive hedone, an uninterrupted engagement in the aesthetic orgiastic experience. Actually, they rejected all laws, all norms. Believe me, sometimes when I read the story of the Mabul, I forget that it was written so many years ago by Moshe. I believe the things I'm reading in an article, in some periodical about the new generation, which wants freedom and rejects all authority and wants to legislate, a code of behavior without accepting any which was imposed. This was the Deira Mabul. And basically, what was the main theme of the Deira Mabul is ki hishchis kol basar. All flesh was corrupted. The call of the flesh, the call of the blood, the biological pressure which demands, gratification, though the flesh reigned supreme. They wanted to exploit every opportunity that might prove to be pleasure-giving. Orgiastic man does not only respond inevitably to biological urges whose fulfillment yields pleasure, but he tries to invent new pressures and unheard of, newly contrived situations which challenge the body to respond by gratifying them and by giving pleasure to man. He creates needs in order actually to gratify them. He doesn't gratify the needs which nature instilled in him, but he creates artificially, synthetically needs in order to gratify them. The Deira Afloge is different. When I read the story of the Deira Afloge, particularly with the footnotes by Rashi, the small print, I think by association, involuntarily I begin to think of Mao Zedong. The Dera Flooded generation, which wanted to build the Babylon Tower with its apex touching the heavens, represents not orgiastic men. Mao Zedong and the Chinese Republic don't represent orgiastic men, men without for pleasure, to enjoy life. On the contrary, there is an ascetic streak to them, to the Dera Flooded and to Mao Zedong and to what's his name, Hu Jintao. If Hu Jintao, I mean, would have subscribed to the code of orgiastic men, to pleasure without limitation, to hedonism without, I mean, to boundless hedonism, we couldn't fight a war against the United States. They couldn't have sacrificed their lives. They couldn't have given the United States such a hard time. They, on the contrary, the Dera Flooded represented authoritarian men, men who wants to rule not only the earth, but the heavens as well. Not pleasure addicted, they did not seek beauty, nor was the aesthetic indulgence their aim. They were power hungry. They were a band of fanatics. A band of fanatics who wanted to rule the world, the heavens as well as the earth. Scoffed at the human, at human faith in God, at human weaknesses, at human time-honored institutions, at the idea of individual dignity and freedom. The clique, it was probably a clique which organized it. The clique was utter contempt for ordinary man. He did not believe that ordinary man can rule himself, can set up an orderly government. They tried to industrialize. The whole construction of the tower means industrialization. Society and enslaved the individual. Of course, not to another individual, but to the state, to the collective, to the group. They were disciplined. But the Rambam was not disciplined. Orgiastic man is never disciplined. They were disciplined, well organized. They had a political code and a very strict code. They were not weakened by abundance. Their character was not softened by overindulgence, by luxurious living. They were aggressive, undertaking, bold in design, and arrogant in execution. And they said to each other, come, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, come, let us build a city and a tower with its top in heaven. If the Communist Party, and the whole ideology of Marxism, the way it was interpreted by Lenin and by Mao Zedong, the whole ideology couldn't have found a better description, a better portrayal than these two psukim in Chumash give us. And basically, if you'll ask me now about the great confrontation between the West and the East, whether I could simply portray this confrontation in biblical terms, I would say it's a confrontation between the Dera Mabul and the Dera Flooded. The West is orgiastic. Basically, what is the ideal of the of Western man? I mean, pleasure, hedonism. Western production is dedicated to consumers' goods, you know very well, to gracious living, to the cultivation of beauty, to luxury, to boundless pleasure, thus portraying the dirigeable Western man. If you just turn on the television or you turn on the radio, you'll hear it immediately. Western man is engaged not only in producing goods in order to gratify basic needs, but to create needs in order to produce goods. This is basically the shibboleth of Western economy. A car is not good enough, so you need more features, more luxury. I mean, I recently came across an ad. The Eastern has introduced a new plane, the luxury plane. What's the luxury plane? They'll serve champagne. So, of course, I mean, you pay more for the ticket. I mean, the fare goes up. It's high enough anyway. But it goes up. They'll steak and champagne. I mean, instead of a plain dinner, a plain sumptuous dinner, they'll serve champagne and some extra steak. The East is the Deraflogger. Is committed, of course, the East, the communist 80s society, is committed to the production of heavy machinery. This is symbolic. To the expansion of their empire. The communist bloc is not pleasure-seeking. On the contrary, there is an ascetic streak in every communist. They produce goods not for the purpose of gratifying modern basic needs, but in order to make men forget his needs. But there is one common feature to both of them. Both of them want to be more than men. They want to be creators. V'yisem kelekim yiditei bara. Now, even though the Torah has portrayed these two ideologies by introducing two generations, and we don't know exactly how far removed these two generations were. Usually, and this is very important, it's of great relevance to modern times and to our own problems. Usually, the hedonic society, orgiastic society, leads necessarily to political tyranny, and the pleasure-conscious individual is ready prey to the intrigue and scheming of a power-hungry evil mind. That happened in Germany. That happened at the Ramabel. The Ramabel was orgiastic. The next generation was already authoritarian. That happened in Germany, basically, in the 30s, in the 20s. I was in Germany. What was Germany of the late 20s, in the early 30s? An orgiastic society. Pleasure. Enjoyment. I mean, the only authority, I mean, was actually the flesh, actually ruled, determined human aspirations, human policies. And never, it was another indulgent, permissive, hedonic, drunk, flesh intoxicated society, and that society tolerated. Why only tolerated, promoted the dominion of evil tyranny and madness. And the same thing might happen here. The so-called freedom movement, which reject all norms, all laws, and every semblance of a regulated, self-limiting life, and preach boundless liberty and unlimited freedom from all authority, may precipitate something monstrous and something wicked. The same happened in the times of Hashem. I'm reading between the lines. The Book of Esther, it's very strange, has not spared words in portraying vividly the absurd, reprehensible addiction of the king and his princes and his courtiers and servants to lascivious pleasures, to the incessant pursuit for a never fugitive satisfaction. The habits of a society which heaps up vast riches, many fair women, and lets go. Third, reprehensible addiction of the king and his princes and his courtiers and servants to lascivious pleasures, to the incessant pursuit for a never fugitive satisfaction. The habits of a society which heaps up vast riches, many fair women, and lets go one good to acquire another, drain one pleasure to the dregs, to try the next, which fills all the weariness of satiety with each as it passes, and anticipate at the same time a new satiety with all that is to come, are described in minutest detail in the Megillah. It's very strange. The Megillah is a part of the canon of the Kisvei HaKedesh. I mean, Beruach HaKedesh Nichtevo. Why was it necessary to perpetuate the names of the eunuchs or the harem keepers, Shashgas and Hegoi? Very important that we should remember their names. Who was the keeper of the harem for the virgins, and Shashgas was for the concubines. Why did the Megillah mention the brands of cosmetics used by the king's concubines? 6 months with one oil, and 6 months with another oil. Is it so important to Yadus? And why did the Megillah tell us about the lewd, foul habits of the king himself? The scriptures, the Torah, which revealed so little about Abraham's life, Abraham's youth, which would have been of great importance to us, so little about Moses. What do you know about Moses? How many episodes are related in Chumash about Moses? Just that he was born, the episode where he was cast into the Nile River, his confrontation with the Ivri and the Mitzri, the Egyptian and the Jew, and then this next confrontation with the Shnei Ivri Mitzri, with the two Jews who are quarreling. And the next appearance of Moses, you know how old he is? 80 years. Because what happened to Moses is Moshe's private affair. Moses is important as long as his life is a part of the life of the covenantal community. And here the Torah tells us in detail about the various habits, foul habits, of Ahasuerus and his princes. The Torah suddenly becomes which tells us the most important, which actually has recorded the most important events in a minimum of words, becomes suddenly loquacious, telling us about the king's wives, the royal banquets, and the degenerate life at court. Why? The answer is simple. Because only in such an environment the rise of Haman was passing. Only people who care about nothing but pleasure may tolerate a demagogue, tyrant, and madman. Only people addicted to the beautiful and pleasant, only people even addicted to art, to music, and painting, can stand by and watch the smoke rising to heaven from the chimneys in Majdane and Oświęcim. As a matter of fact, it's very strange. If you read about the story of the extermination of the Vilna community, I forgot his name was Weiss. As a matter of fact, he has not been executed yet. I read at the American Jewish, at the World Jewish Congress, and I brought complaints to the, tried to bring complaints to the Russian government, not Russian, to the Austrian government, that they should prosecute Weiss. Weiss was an accomplished musician. And his specialty was Chopin and Mozart. So when the first of all, you know, Nazis, I mean, killed, exterminated Jewish babies, infants. They used to collect, like the Mitzrim of old, used to collect Jewish babies. They used to line them up in front of Weiss, in the yard of the Gestapo offices. And Weiss, he could play the piano beautifully with one hand, with the left hand. So with the left hand, they used to play Mozart. And with the right hand, he held a revolver, a gun, and shoot. He used to shoot baby by baby. It's a very strange combination, music and bloodshed and murder, mass murder. It's not, there's no contradiction. If man is addicted to beauty only, and beauty is the final goal of man, so then any crime is possible. And that's why the Torah says, Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh. Do you want to know why all this bloody nonsense happened? Because Achashverosh was king. In society was pleasure addicted. It was an orgiastic society, an artistically minded society, conscious of the arts of music and so forth, of beauty, a pleasure addicted society, a beauty addicted society is capable of tolerating genocide and any and murder and any kind of crime. And then the Megillah tells us, gives us just the background, just portrays society. Achashverosh was the society. Achashverosh, the princess, what kind of a society it was? What did they discuss? What their aspirations were? And achar hadvarim ha'ele, is no wonder that Gidal HaMelech Achashverosh has someone ben Amdoso. It's no wonder. Exactly what happened in Germany in 1932-33. Why should a pleasure-loving society lead to political tyranny and loss of the moral conscience? The answer to it, I believe, can be found in another verse. It's a very prima facie verse, I mean, it doesn't impress us. Vayhi bayim ha-shvi'i kitov lev ha-melech bayoyin. Omar, the seven servants, lohovi esvashti ha-malko lifnei ha-melech, v'ches ha-malchus, la-ari so-amim ve-asorim es-yofyo kitev ha-smari. Always the moral conscience is always lost when the individual submerges in the crowd, when public opinion is accepted as the highest guide and as the highest criterion, when you look for consensus. When the king, the princess and the people got drunk, intoxicated because of feasting, morality, decency, humanity itself was gone. Orgiastic man forfeits his individuality when he disappears in the crowd. An orgiastic man is prone to disappearance in the crowd, to submerge in the crowd completely. Now let me just describe a bit and also compare with principles of Yadis. You know very well that the crowd has been an object of psychological and sociological study since ever. What has been proven, I mean, can be formulated in a few sentences. First, the crowd is not just an aggregate of individuals, a loosely organized collective. This is not a crowd. It is more than that. The crowd is an entirely new ego, a separate identity, which is totally different from its component parts. In what respect is the crowd individuality unique and does differ from its separate individual members? The answer, I believe, is as follows. The crowd is emotionally excitable. Its emotional dynamics increase and gain intensity and power of thrust, while the crowd is easily aroused into action, while its intellectual and rational capacity is considerably reduced. Therefore, the crowd is easy prey for all tyrants, demagogues, and false prophets. The collective composite individuality is an overgrown baby, ready at the same time to cry and to laugh, to reject or to rejoice or to despair hysterically, while it is impossible for the crowd to understand the nature of its own action and would feel completely perplexed and embarrassed if called upon to account rationally for its performance. We Jews, in our history, know from experience what an inflamed, roused, and motley crowd of fanatics can accomplish. It's capable of, because the massacres, we'll take the massacres, for instance, of the perpetrated by the mobs of the Crusaders in the 11th century, 12th century, by the Khmelnytsky hordes in the 17th century, the catastrophe of the Hitler era, actually, were partly due, attributable to the ruthlessness of an excited mob, its lack of resistance to the persuasive words of charlatans and wicked, bloodthirsty demagogues and individuals. At times, particular Christian church tried to utilize the gullibility of the crowd for constructive purposes, for religious revival and awakening, you know, the revival meetings, for arousing bravery or valor on the field of battle. However, over the period of many centuries, the crowd has been the vehicle of vulgar, crude, cruel, and inhumane emotions, rather than that of the noble, gentle feeling and refined sentiments. In the Book of Esther, we come across the aroused, drunk crowd, which casts off human shame and dignity and begins to act like a herd at the time of mating. On the seventh day, and the Megillah tells us so beautifully, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry, the seven chamberlains were sent that minister in the presence of the king to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal to show the peoples and the princess her beauty, for she was lovely to look on.